You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
17 seconds from game 7 or from championship number 6. Jordan, open! Chicago with the lead! Portland has 3 timeouts left. The Lakers have 2. Bryant to Shaq! The 0-1 pitch. A liner off Nagy's glove into center field. The Florida Marlins have won the World Series.
Those are just some of the iconic calls by our guests today on the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, and in a moment, my co-host Armand Brody and I will be joined by Bob Costas for an in-depth conversation about his career, spanning his time with NBC Sports through his most recent work with TBS. Before we get to that, if you have not already, please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Well, with no further ado, let's go straight to the interview. Armand and I spoke with Bob on Wednesday afternoon, and it was a conversation that I hope you all enjoy. All right. Well, we are extremely honored to be joined today by one of the greatest sports broadcasters of all time. And you are undoubtedly familiar with Bob Costas, who, of course, is the voice of so many sports moments over generations for NBC Sports, most recently with TBS doing baseball, and has also been on MLB Network for many years as well. One of the greatest broadcasters, and I know, obviously, you don't want to be overwhelming with the praise, but I don't think I'm being too overwhelming in saying that. And Bob, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Armin. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, why don't we get started with kind of the genesis of all of this, which is an article that Armand wrote on the site. It was an article about your career and kind of the end of it. We all know that the TBS games last year, there was a lot of criticism of the call, the Yankees and the Royals, and just kind of the broader topic of announcers as they move through their career and some of the issues that occur. And I wanted to give you your ability to kind of speak about that topic, that article, and some of the criticism that you got toward the end of last year.
Well, there's multiple layers here. The reason I am here with Armand and you, John, is that not only did I respect what Armand wrote, I agreed with it. A lot of the criticism, if you want to call it that, was uninformed, not so much about the particulars of 4 games in October, but about the much larger subject of a long career in baseball broadcasting and an even longer career when you take everything into consideration in broadcasting itself. And Armand's observations included that. It was a textured piece that you and he put together. And not only did I not take any offense to it, I respected it greatly. And it aligned with my own feeling. The TBS portion of my career is a tiny chip in a much larger mosaic, if that's not too overblown. But we all want to end on a grace note. This is not the end of my broadcasting career, but it most definitely was going to be the end of my play-by-play career by my own design. Even had I been asked back and the Baseball Network had wanted me to do more games, which they do, I said, no, this is going to be the end. And it didn't quite turn out the way I wanted it to. Now, why does that bother me to the whatever extent it does? Does it hurt in the mind of any reasonable person the overall grade of my career? I don't think so. Does it alter what my possibilities are going forward? No, it doesn't. But I do have regard for my craft. I don't care what your craft is. If you have respect and regard for it, if you did it wonderfully well 100 times and the 101st fell short of that standard, even if nobody noticed, you don't feel right about it, because that's the difference between just caring about what the rabble says and caring about your own standard and what you know to be the standard that you consistently reach. So it bothered me just from that standpoint. I thought that I could end with something that, if it didn't match my career batting average, it was at least close enough for those who have followed me and have a positive feeling about me to say, yeah, that's a nice closing chapter to a long book. The other reason that it bothered me especially, it would have bothered me in any case to not reach my own standard, but especially when it came to baseball, because baseball has always been, for all the other things that I've been lucky enough to do, the Olympics, the NBA, whatever it might be, baseball has always been number one with me. Somebody once referred to me as a citizen of the game. Now, that includes play-by-play, but the reason they said that was because I think I had some standing within the game. The eulogies for all of Hall of Famers who called upon me or their families did. Ken Burns' baseball documentary. The book I wrote about the state of baseball at the beginning of this century, which makes it sound even longer ago than it was. Should have said in 2000. The various essays and commentaries, as well as the play-by-play of the games. And so because of that, I didn't want broadcasters who had looked up to me, younger guys, people within the game who had expressed appreciation for what I had done and how I had done it. I didn't want to let any of them down. And as I've now said a few times, I didn't want to fall too far beneath my own standard. So you hope that you can end, as I've said on a grace note. You don't want the last note of a symphony, if that's not too overblown, to be discordant. But also, I don't want people to misunderstand. A lot of people just hang on. A lot of people, if you gave them truth serum, they'd say, I want to die in the booth. I want my last words to be back after this, and I keel over and they drag me out. Don't just take my word for it. There's evidence to this effect. In the early 1990s, I asked to be taken off NBC's NFL coverage, the most watched thing on a year-in, year-out basis in all of television, even by that point, because I felt that my calendar was a bit too full, and of all the sports that I did, even if football was the most popular, it was the one I was least attached to. When Marv Albert had to step aside for a while, and Dick Ebersol, my patron at NBC, asked me to leave the studio and call the games, it turned out, parenthetically, to be a very lucky break for me, because I lucked into the Last Dance season in 1998. But I told Dick from that very moment on, if and when Marv is able to come back, this is his job. Basketball is the sport he's most associated with. I will willingly hand the baton back to him when he returns. And that's what happened. I did 3 seasons, and I was happy that Marv was able to come back. When NBC got base football back, Sunday Night Football, in the early 2000s, had it not been for Ebersol's personal plea, I never would have returned to football. But it was important to him. He did turn Sunday Night Football into the highest rated primetime show. And because of our very close relationship and his desire to put together the strongest possible team, I did it. When Ebersol left NBC, when Comcast took over in 2011, I was poised to leave with him. It had already been a long and fruitful run, and I checked a lot of boxes. The Comcast people immediately step up and they say, you're to sports what Tom Brokaw is to news. We want you to stay, and if you want, we'll put an emeritus clause in the contract whenever you want to step aside. So this is 2012, and I say, okay, I'll do the Olympics through 2016 and Sunday Night Football concurrent with that, but I'm stepping aside. In 2015, they say to me, you can go on a year-by-year or season-by-season basis, season-by-season in football, Olympics by Olympics on that. I said, no, let's stick with the plan. So it's 2016. I am a very young 64, and by my own design, I step away from it. And I take on an emeritus role at NBC, so I comment on historical stuff, issues, tributes to those who passed away, the things that were appropriate in my mind for me to be involved in at that point. And continuing with the Baseball Network, which was also appropriate. Then NBC and I get sideways. That's in the process of mending itself now. So that maybe I can achieve that grace note back where I belong at NBC, but that's a separate story. So we get sideways, mostly over my comments about CTE in football and the IOC's troubling affinity for authoritarian regimes. And at that point, maybe, and I think it was short-sighted on both parties, some passive-aggressive stuff going on, maybe both of us couldn't see the forest for the trees, and we threw up our hands and said, okay, been a good long run. Let's settle it. And so we settled it, and I stepped away. At that point, now this is a very long explanation, but I'm giving it to you because, Armand, in our conversations, you've made it clear to me that you and your audience are interested in this, and this is the full story with nothing left out, and there's no spin on it. This is exactly what happened and why it happened. So Jeff Zucker, whose first job out of Harvard had been to be as Bryant Gumbel's researcher and mine at the 88 Olympics in Korea, he by then is running CNN. He says, why don't you come over and be a contributor at CNN to talk about when sports crosses over into news? Sure, that's great. He's my friend. That's a comfortable situation. And at the same time, HBO beckoned me back, and I did a couple of years on HBO in a program that won several Emmy nominations, and we were very proud of. But again, as an aside, almost no one has connected the dots on this. HBO Sports has shuttered. Once the gold standard of a certain kind of broadcast sports journalism, Bryant Gumbel, you know, couched it as a retirement, but the whole landscape had changed dramatically. So the documentary unit. Right now, there's that Celtic City documentary, but that's being done under the broader documentary unit of HBO. There is no more sports documentary department that used to churn out three or four highly acclaimed documentaries a year. There's no more Bomani Jones. There's no more Costa Show. There's no more Real Sports, which was the 60 Minutes of sports. So for a brief moment, it appeared as if, well, this is going to be kind of my sunset home, doing things, not so much inventory, not as widely seen as on NBC, but things that really resonated for me and for those who followed a certain portion of what I did in my career. And Zucker kind of is overseeing all of it. Then for about an eye blank, Jeff becomes the head of Turner Sports. And so he says he's trying to make a splash. They acquired hockey. He signs Wayne Gretzky to be part of the coverage. He wants me to join their baseball coverage in a much more expansive way than I was comfortable with. I didn't want to bump anybody else who was in the prime of their career. And finally, he convinced me to at least do the division series. And I thought, okay, you know what? I didn't quite get the closing note at NBC. You know, I didn't need, as I've said many times, a brass band and a parade, but you don't want to just disappear without the slightest bit of closure. I would have been happy to host some program and then for 2 minutes at the end say, well, it's been a wonderful ride. Thanks a lot, everybody. So long. But without that, there's an empty feeling. So I'm thinking maybe baseball for one season with Jeff, maybe baseball can give me that. And I specifically asked to do the Yankees series, not because as numbskulls who always think someone is rooting against their team, the same fans of both teams hear the same words and conclude that the announcer, the national announcer, doesn't like their team. Not for that reason, but because the Yankees connect, not in a way that would affect the objectivity of a good professional broadcaster, but they do connect to my childhood as a baseball fan. So that seemed to be a good entry and exit point simultaneously. Then Jeff got sideways with Time Warner and he was gone. And my mistake was, after that one season, I should have said, I'm only here because of Jeff's invitation. I'll leave now. But TBS wanted me to do a couple more years. And I thought, okay, I will. And I honestly thought, if I thought that I couldn't perform at least close to my past standard, I wouldn't have done it. I realized that I was no longer at whatever my top level was, but I thought I could get close enough. And I prepared very hard, and I thought I made allowances for any diminution in sharpness or whatever. And it didn't quite turn out that way. But that's the reason that all of this happened as it did. So there is no way in the world that I was, you know, standing on a street corner going, remember me, famous broadcaster, I want to be on the air, please put me back on the air. Very, very close to the opposite of that. I've described the circumstances. I realize I've described it exhaustively. And now I guarantee that this will be aggregated and misrepresented by numbskulls, careless people, and knaves out there on the internet.
Bob, do you feel things would have ended more gracefully had you gotten that classic series? I mean, you did not have much to work with in the way of really classic postseason moments. Do you feel it would have been different for you?
A little. Yeah, that is a valid observation. But it's not an all-encompassing excuse. I wasn't as good as I used to be, and as I hoped, if not expected, to be. There's ample evidence of that. MLB put out a 45-minute long compilation of various calls through the years. I didn't put it together. They did. There's a show called The Sounds of Baseball that MLB aired more than a year ago, and then they repeated it. I don't know if that's accessible on the internet, but if you compare objectively and fairly the calls from last October to the bulk of the 40 years, it doesn't match up. But to your point, of the seven postseason series, not counting the wild card series, but you've got, I guess, how many division series? Four division series, then two LCSs and the World Series. Six of the seven had exciting and dramatic moments. One pretty much did not, as it happened. It was Yankees Royals. The road team won three of the four games. Kansas City never led in the two games in Kansas City. Now that I think of it, there was a near home run in the bottom of the eighth inning that could have tied the game in game four and set up a deciding game five back in New York. And I think if you listen to that call, if that was the only thing you heard, you would say, well, he was just the same as he was in 1995. There was a little bit to work with there.
Sends this one to deep right. Back goes Soto by the bullpen. And he's got it with his back against the bullpen fence. On a different night, without the wind, this might very well be a tie game.
But that's a small factor. At the heart of it was that even if it had been a great series, my performance on it would not have been as good as many of the great series that I did in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And I hadn't even thought about this or been aware of it. I just went back and checked. I had been nominated in the play-by-play category, and it was only baseball by this time because I was doing it at the Baseball Network, as recently as 2017 or 2018. So it isn't like, oh, he was good in the 80s and 90s. You know, if I hadn't been reasonably capable of doing it, then the Baseball Network would not have made me their first hire, and I wouldn't have wound up getting into the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame the first year I showed up on the ballot. That's based on a career's body of work. And now I'm repeating myself yet again. I just wanted the end to be in accord, if not exactly matching up with, at least in accord with what the bulk of it had been.
You know, you talk about the critics, and obviously there's so many now in the social media era than there ever were in the 1990s. You have been very open about ways you felt like you fell short in that postseason. But what do you think was said that was unfair about your performance last year?
Well, everything is exaggerated on the internet. I mean, with exceptions, there are insightful and reasonable and nuanced and knowledgeable things said. But there is no bar of entry, not only on X or Twitter, or to be commenter number 473 after whatever article, but for many of these sites themselves, to be someone whose name is attached to the post, there's no bar of entry there either. No one's going to hold you to account. Either, you know, did you make a phone call? Did you check on that? What's your source? Why did you say what you said or wrote what you wrote? None of that. So, with notable exceptions, there are no misdemeanors on the internet, only felonies. Everything is binary. All the gray areas of the nuance is lost. And I'm not even remotely aware of anything more than a tiny fraction of what's out there. How could you be? You'd be out of your mind to dive too deeply into that morass. But just to give you an example, seemingly unrelated to this, and this did somehow come across my radar, because it was on a site, I forget what the site was, but some site that had a name, okay? And it must have been 10 years ago or so when David Letterman was leaving late night. And the premise of the article, interesting premise, what sports broadcasters could do a late night show? And so the author says, you know, Dan Patrick might be good at this and so might be good at that. And then my name came up and this is what he said. Bob Costas couldn't possibly do a late night show unless it was done on PBS. Now, we're not talking about doing some deep dive like your Doris Kearns Goodwin writing a history. How about the minimum level? Saying that is like, I'm going to go broadcast a baseball game. How many balls are a walk and how many strikes? I'm just trying to get that clear. Okay. Not only had I done a pretty damn successful an extremely well-received late-night show in the late 80s and early 90s. But since the premise of the thing was about David Letterman, it's kind of common knowledge that David Letterman, when he left NBC and went to CBS, offered me the hour after his show, which he controlled, because I had followed him on NBC, and it was a tempting offer, but I turned it down. Now, again, if the guy had never mentioned me in the article, my thing isn't, geez, how come he's not praising me? But if you're going to say something about anybody, at least have your ducks in a row. At least have a basic understanding of what you're talking about. But one of the things that, especially in this era, where it would be exceedingly rare if anyone who does a talk show someplace, you know, on the air, actual classic on the air on the radio, or has a blog or some sort of internet platform. I'm not talking about commenters or people on Twitter or X. Exceedingly rare to hear from any of them just, hey, there's an issue that you're involved in or a story that you're involved in. Clear this up for me. There isn't one of them could ever say that I lied if they asked me a question. But what you get, for example, we talked earlier about me leaving NBC. And there was a story on ESPN that Mark Fainaruwada did, a very esteemed journalist. He and his brother, League of Denial, Game of Shadows, that's top flight sports journalism. And Mark wanted to do, in effect, an appreciation of my career as I left NBC. And a small aspect from my standpoint was that I was scheduled to host the 2018 Olympics because Mike Tirico had to be in Korea only a few days after for the first Olympics that he'd be the primetime host. So they didn't want him to be fighting the jet lag and the double preparation. So they said, we'll take you out of mothballs, in effect, part of the emeritus deal. Will you host the Olympics? I host the Super Bowl. I said, okay, that's what you want me to do. And then when my criticisms of the NFL and the CTE issue picked up, they must have decided, undoubtedly with a nudge from the league, you know, Bob isn't the right guy to be hosting this six-hour celebration of football. And when they presented that to me, my immediate response was, okay, yeah, I guess you're right. I'd actually rather interview Roger Goodell for 15 or 20 minutes on the Super Bowl at this stage of my career. I've already hosted six or seven of them. I'd rather do that than host. The way this somehow got spun out was, oh, Costas wants to say whatever he wants about the NFL, but then he complains that he's not hosting the Super Bowl. Not only did I not complain, it didn't matter a thimble's worth to me. And even people who said, I agree with everything Costas said about CTE, but I can't criticize my employer and expect that my employer won't fire me or have some sort of reaction to it. That's an entirely incorrect framing of what happened. Just as at the beginning of this conversation, the framing of what happened with the baseball and TBS. And if only, and I have to give someone like Andrew Marchand at The Athletic credit, but not many, people just write whatever they write. You know, there's, especially on the internet, all these aggregators, they get stuff in transcript form. Now, if you've ever watched TV with closed captioning, it's amazing technology, but you see that there are spelling errors all the time. So I was on with Michael Kay in New York a couple of years ago, and somehow the subject of the internet came up, and I said, look, Twitter is a thing. And so it's a thing, and if you're looking at it judiciously, perhaps you can refer to it. But people shouldn't treat Twitter as if it's a pew poll. P-E-W, new word, P-O-L-L. The transcript read, you shouldn't treat Twitter as if it's a pupil, P-U-P-I-L. Every single website that aggregated that printed it as is. Now, maybe there's no editor, but the writer himself, there is someone's name at the top of it. It's not like, you know, a Twitter or X post from, you know, Jerkwad 602 in Seattle or something. You have an actual name. You're looking at this. This sentence makes no sense. This is the sort of thing that if it was turned in by your sixth grade son or daughter, would come back with all kinds of red marks and see me from the teacher. Okay, we're talking about standards that are so low. Standards of quality, of credibility, of honesty, of fairness, when the only thing you want is something that will get clicks. Hey, it's not a bad thing to get clicks, but it would be a really good thing to get clicks for something that's worthy, something that stands up to some kind of reasonable scrutiny. But I think that that standard now is almost old-fashioned, at least when it comes to the internet. That's why I had no problem at all with what Armand wrote about my closing moments calling baseball. It was more than fair. He didn't speak to me beforehand, but he didn't have to because it was knowledgeable. He had a broad understanding of what the topic was, and it was all contextual. It was nuanced. And not only did I not object to it, I respected it, which is why I'm here with you guys. So to your point or to your question, what bothered me was not people who said, he's lost something on his fastball. That's fair, that's reasonable, and regrettably, I have to agree with it. But those who said, oh, he's fine in the studio, but he's not a good play-by-play man. Well, some people may say, I like him as a play-by-play man. I liked him even better as an essayist, an interviewer, this, that, or the other thing. But, and no one is universally popular. There are people out there who dislike even those who by consensus are acclaimed. But the consensus for decades about me as a baseball announcer was very, very positive. Now, if you want to preface your thing by saying, I know what most people think, but I never liked him, that's different. But the flat statement, he's good at this and this, but he's a terrible play-by-play man, there isn't much evidence at all to back that up.
You should be applauded, I think, for at least saying to yourself, I'm not what I used to be. I'm not as good as I once was. It takes a lot of self-awareness to do that. In the autumn of your career, to have that level of humility, I do think you have to be in a mature place to say to yourself, as much as I want to be able to do it at the top level, that highest level, at my peak, I'm just not there. You mentioned, Bob, the NBC years. We want to sort of talk about those final years just a little bit. Because you part ways late 2018, early 2019, very unceremonious departure there. Yeah. Confusion for a lot of people who had followed your career for so many decades. And during that time, you talked a lot about being ambivalent about football.
Yes.
While covering the sport. Obviously, the concussion issue was a big deal. What are your thoughts now looking back on those final days?
It should have ended more graciously and in a more mutually respectful way. And I think quite possibly, had it happened that way, I might not have done the baseball on TBS. You know, I was kind of looking for something to kind of tie a ribbon around it and not for any, you know, ladder climbing career ambition, not for the money part of it, but just for the reasons we've been discussing. And in fact, I suggested to them, and maybe if we're able to work out a return, this will happen in some form. I had suggested back in 2018, why don't we do a show called 40 Years of NBC Sports? It would be natural in the minds of the audience for me to host that show. You do it on some fallow Saturday or Sunday when there isn't much out there, and it's like catnip to the audience. It's not all the great event, not just all the great events. It's all the great voices. It's Marv Albert. It's Kurt Gowdy. It's Don Crickey. It's Tom Hammond. It's Vin Scully. It's on and on, right? And I would be the host of it. A handful of the dozens and dozens of play-by-play calls would be me, but I'd be almost incidental, except as the host. And then right at the end, I would say something like, which I could say right here off the top of my head, wow, what an incredible 40 years. So many great moments. And it was my good fortune to be part of so many of them. Thanks to everyone I worked for and with. Thanks to all of you for watching. I'll see you somewhere down the road. For all of us at NBC Sports, Bob Costas, so long. That would have been more than good enough for me. You know, a lot of other people, and I'm happy for them. They deserved it. But a lot of other people whose tenure was not as long nor as wide in terms of all the things I did, both in and out of sports for NBC, a lot of people receive a much more fulsome tribute, and they deserve every bit of it. I'm happy for them. But that was a little off that it happened that way. And that sort of left me for looking for the ribbon. And maybe, in a bit of poetic justice, that ribbon is found right back at 30 Rock, but we'll have to see. Nothing certain yet, but maybe.
Everyone's talking about AI these days, right? This season on Compiler, we're diving deep into how AI is reshaping the world we live in. Join us for a new season of Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Men, if you've lost your hair, it doesn't mean you can't find it again. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions, and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who found their hair again. It can be hard for men to deal with hair loss, even though it is common. Luckily, I'm here to provide you with a solution so you don't even have to talk about it. Through Hims, you can restore your hair by accessing their personalized hair loss solutions. Men value many different things about their appearance. But if you're a guy who really cares about your hair and find that it's slowly going away, you might be feeling discouraged when you look in the mirror. And that's where Hims comes in. Check out their personalized hair loss solutions, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients, like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. Answer a few questions, and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You know, you were loyal to NBC for a lot of years, including some very lean years there. NBC lost the NFL in 98. You weren't part of the NFL at that point, but lost baseball, obviously, in 2000, and lost the NBA in 2002. There was some reporting at the time, and you can correct me if this is wrong, that ESPN was pursuing you for the NBA around that time and would have allowed you to continue doing the Olympics for NBC while doing the NBA for them. I don't know if there was any truth to that, but you stayed. I wanted to know what was, you know, your thought about the relationship and the loyalty that you showed them and opportunities to go elsewhere. I mean, you mentioned the CBS Letterman opportunity as well.
Yeah. Well, in answer to your question, sure, over the years. And I'm sure that other broadcasters, contemporaries, or some that came along a little bit later, Joe Buck, Jim Nance, Al Michaels, I'm sure they all had overtures. In fact, Al did leave ABC to come to NBC. But my whole career, you know, I'd done a handful of regional things for CBS when I was in my early and mid-20s, but essentially my whole career had been at NBC. And the idea of being something that in sports is becoming a dying breed, to be Carl Yastrzemski or Brooks Robinson or Al Kaline or whomever you want to name, or, you know, Magic or Michael, Larry Bird, just one team. That's part of what sets them apart. Not to compare myself to them, but the idea that your whole career is in one place. That's your broadcast home. So that was always significant to me. Plus, I couldn't deny that NBC had helped me to build my career. You know, I didn't arrive gift-wrapped as, here's your host of the Olympics, here's your World Series and NBA Finals guy. They had to identify that in me and cultivate that in me and stand behind me. So I was grateful to them for that. And I was especially grateful to Dick Ebersol, who created the late-night program with me in mind and who made me the primetime host of the Olympics and who, after we lost baseball in the late 80s and then got it back in the mid-90s, made me no longer the host, but the play-by-play guy of the World Series. And he had done so many solid things for me, not just professionally, but personally. Little things like, I'm living in St. Louis, my kids are young, and there's always a Christmas night game on NBC. And in that era, it was always Michael and the Bulls. He would exempt me from all the pregame stuff, and he would send the plane to St. Louis to wait until I'd had Christmas with my family and kids. I'd get on the plane. I'd get to the arena a couple hours before the game. I'd call the game, and I'd be back in St. Louis short flight before midnight on Christmas night. Or on Thanksgiving, when we did it from the studio, he'd let me leave after halftime and not stick around for the post game and fly back to St. Louis in time to have a late Thanksgiving dinner. So there was a very deep personal as well as professional connection between me and Dick. Sometimes, to be honest, we butted heads because I sometimes had ideas of my own. I agreed with Dick's vision 95% of the time, but the 5%, I felt like I ought to speak up. And sometimes I prevailed, and more often than not, he prevailed. But at least I got my point of view out there. But, you know, the answer is, it wasn't just the network. It was the guy at the head of the network sports division, Dick Ebersole. It was my loyalty to him as well as to the network.
You know, to that point, obviously, I mentioned before NBC losing baseball. How much do you think that second loss, that 2000 loss, affected your career in baseball? Because had NBC renewed, had everything stayed status quo, NBC gets the 2001 World Series. NBC gets Marlins Cubs in the 03 NLCS. And NBC gets Red Sox Yankees in the 04 ALCS. Yep. So you are calling the three of the greatest series of all time, if the status quo holds.
That's true. I was lucky enough. I didn't realize the numbers until the MLB Network put together some kind of resume or calculation of this. I knew I had done three World Series. I didn't realize I'd done 10 LCSs mixed in there and all the All-Star games and all the rest. So you can't say that I was shortchanged. But could it have been what you said? Sure. Sure, it could have been. Joe Buck has been a great baseball announcer, and I think he should long since have received the Frick Award, and someday he will, and he will have the additional distinction. He's already joined his dad in the football broadcaster's wing, and soon enough they'll both be, I hope, both be recipients of the Frick Award. But Joe's baseball career could not have been as great if Fox didn't have all the World Series for like more than two decades. Jim Nance is made to call golf. But if he wasn't at CBS and if CBS didn't have the Masters, which of all the majors is the one that resonates most, now you have to, just because you have the canvas doesn't mean you're guaranteed to be Van Gogh or something. But those are guys that knew what to do with the canvas. And so I had that canvas for a while in the 80s and 90s, but to your point, had it extended into the 2000s, then sure, my baseball resume would not only have been fuller, especially the big events, the big October events, but it would have been more recent. And maybe some younger people who associate me with the Olympics and didn't watch much of the baseball network, it's a relatively boutique, smaller audience thing, you know, they associate me with the Super Bowl and with the Kentucky Derby and the Olympics and the World Series and stuff that I, and the NBA Finals that I may have done in the 80s and 90s. But I can't blame someone who's 30 years old. All of a sudden I pop up on TBS and they think, well, why is he doing baseball? You know, they're not required to do homework on that if they're just plopping down on the couch. However, to our earlier point, if you're going to write about it, even in the Wild West, no holds barred of the internet, then you are required to have at least a basic working knowledge of the subject matter.
So do you watch those series? Because Joe had so many of them at Fox in that time. Is there one in particular where you say, man, I wish I would have been on the call for that one?
You know, I this is very honest on my part. I've just never had that feeling. Does it run through your head occasionally, what you might have said in a certain situation? But not from the standpoint of, boy, I really resent the fact that I'm not there. I know there are some people in the business, I hope it's a minority, who root not only for their own success, but they resent the success of others. I've never had a thimble's worth of that feeling ever at any point in my life. I'm happy for other people's success. How, to an intelligent observer, does that in any way diminish me if Joe Buck does great? Or if Mike Tirico, who I think was a worthy successor to both me and Al Michaels, if he thrives as he has, how does that in any way reflect negatively on me? It reflects positively on him, and I'm applauding him. Plus, if you have any legitimate self-confidence, not conceit, but legitimate self-confidence, you're aware that if you're any good at all, there are things that distinguish you, not elevate you above, but distinguish you from even the best of your contemporaries and colleagues. So I was good in somewhat different ways than Al Michaels was good, or Jim Nance was good, or now Mike Tirico, or Joe Buck, or Ian Eagle, or whoever you want to name is good. I did things differently, and I did different things. You know, some of the things I did, other sportscasters of my era didn't do at all. But even within the things that we all did, I had a different approach sometimes, took a more journalistic approach, leaned more toward being an essayist as well as a play-by-play man. That doesn't make me better, but it does make me distinctive. Just as Vin Scully was always distinctive, and so was Jack Buck. They're both great baseball announcers in their own distinctive way. So to your point, when I watched those World Series, quite honestly, my first thought was, wow, what a great World Series. Oh, what a great LCS. And my second thought was, hey, Joe's doing a great job.
Kind of going back to the golden age of NBC sports. And there was a period of time where NBC had everything. The Olympics, yep. Right? The NFL. You might remember the little stinger they would air at the end of a telecast with all of the events that they carried.
The NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, the PGA Tour, Notre Dame Football, the USGA Championships, the Breeders' Cup, Wimbledon, the Ryder Cup, the French Open, the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, and the 2002 Olympic Winter Games in Salt Lake City. All on America's sports leader, NBC.
And you were a part of so many of those. I'm curious, was there ever a point at the height of your career where you were saying to yourself, you know what, let me step back a little bit. I don't have to be part of everything.
Yes. And also the commuting back and forth, because a lot of what I was doing was studio work, commuting between St. Louis and New York, and my kids were young, early grade school, that kind of thing. Although, staying in sports, part of that decision was my kids, because when Letterman offered me and CBS offered me the hour after his, which would have been to do the same type of show that I had been doing at NBC, kind of an eclectic interview show. But they included within that a correspondence position at 60 Minutes, which was very tempting and very prestigious. But as I put it, the shorthand is, you can't say to an 8-year-old kid, I'm interviewing the Secretary of State, want to come? But you can say, not just in theory, it happened all the time throughout their childhood. Let's go to the NBA Finals. Let's go to the World Series. Let's go to the Olympics. And I think that enriched their childhoods, and it also enriched my relationship with my son and my daughter. So part of stepping away, there were family reasons for that. There was also the ambivalence about football, which I'd mentioned earlier. But there came a time, now that I think of it, let's say 2000, right? I did the NBA Finals and all the biggest regular season games and playoff games leading up to it, followed that with the All-Star Game, baseball All-Star Game, followed that by hosting the Olympics in Australia, and came back in time to do the LCS between the Yankees and the Mariners. So at that point, I guess you couldn't possibly be any more visible than I was. But I was still in my 40s, and I had plenty of energy for it. I was surrounded by people who were extremely capable, producers, directors, researchers, partners in the booth, people I liked very much. So the energy and the adrenaline of it gets you past it, even at the Olympics, where, you know, it seems like you're on the air for 24 hours at a time.
Why do people remember the NBA on NBC so fondly, Bob?
Well, I think, first of all, Michael Jordan and the Bulls are at the heart of it. But then think of the constellation of stars. If Michael is at the hub of that, now mixing metaphors, then think of all the spokes of that wheel. Think of the roster of the first Dream Team in 92 in Barcelona. They're all Hall of Famers. They're all bold-faced names. And, you know, the present NBA gets some criticism, some of it valid, certain sameness in approach, over-reliance on the three-pointer. But there are so many remarkably gifted players in the league. You know, the next time they revisit this, NBA at 50, NBA's top 75, the 100, the 25 that have been will be added, it won't just be 25. Some of the 75 are going to drop off because there's so many super talented players in the NBA now and in the years ahead. But having said that, so that I get myself off the hook and it doesn't sound like I'm ripping the NBA, the teams, the good teams in the 80s and 90s were distinctive. It wasn't just that the Lakers played the Celtics and they were both good. They were distinctively good. The Jazz were distinctively different than the Suns, even though they both met and lost to the Bulls. Olajuwon's Rockets were different than Riley's Knicks, who they played in the finals. You know, Atlanta never got there, but they had Dominique Wilkins. There was just so much texture to the league. The Spurs have Duncan and Robinson, but the Lakers have Shaq and Kobe. Easy to identify with. And then at the heart of it is Jordan and the ongoing melodrama of the two three-peats and will Jordan stay or go? And then to your point, Armand, it was the NBA on NBC. And Dick Ebersol and all of the people who worked under him, I don't think a network could possibly do a better job of presenting and legitimately, not hype, legitimately dramatizing a league. You know, all those openings that people miss and they hope that NBC reprises them, those dramatic openings, they weren't bullshit. They took stuff that was true and amplified it and dramatized it. You know, it was a combination of a form of journalism, but also theater. That's what we tried to do.
It's clear now the most important game of the NBA's regular season was March 1st, Portland at Chicago. Not so much for the Bulls' easy victory, but rather for Phil Jackson's bold comment on the eve of the game.
I think this club, Portland, represents a team that plays in spurts, but they'll self-destruct.
The game was never close enough to test Jackson's theory. Chicago wrote a glaring overmatch at small forward, Scottie Pippen outscoring Jerome Kersey by 18 points in a 20-point blowout. And the point Michael Jordan made afterward stung all the more. The Bulls had publicly amplified 3 years' worth of doubt about this Portland franchise, and suddenly, what had been only whispered around the NBA was now spoken openly. Portland was good, but they lacked the resourcefulness and savvy to win close, important games. And so, for the past 3 months, the Blazers have endured daily questions, not about their shooting or their rebounding, but about their judgment and on-court leadership. Portland has protested occasionally, but the slander has been so caustic, so routine, that the Blazers now know they have only one effective reply.
And when you think of how those games were presented, both in the pregame, you know, the setup stuff, Marv Albert calling the games with the czar, the telestrator, Mike Fratello, then Doug Collins comes along, and there was never anybody better from a technical standpoint as a basketball analyst than Collins. We had identifiable people in our studio setups, and our producers and directors were just so good. And we were so in sync. You know, every shot matched. Every little bit of B-roll that supplemented what I may have been saying, or Marv or Tom Hammond might have been saying, was pitch perfect. There was such synchronicity between the booth, the studio, and the truck. I don't think you can do it any better. And then there was John Tesh's Round Ball Rock. You need a signature, right? And so, you know, then I'd finish or Marv would finish, whatever the setup was. Game five, next. You know, and then the NBC Peacock unfurls. And to this day, I have people who are now 60 years old say, I got goosebumps and I wanted to jump out and play the game myself. And during the commercial, I went in the backyard and shot on my backyard hoop, and then I ran back in. And hey, it's theater, right? Now, as you know, you followed me. I'm not a hype guy. I don't try to sell you bullshit. And I think that's one of the reasons why people believed it, because I was willing to be, I hope, fair, but critical where it was due, or skeptical where it was due, or call attention to the elephants in the room. But then when I turned around and said, this is incredible, either I flatly said it or my voice or my tone indicated it, I think people believed that. I think there are some announcers where, you know, they're always in hype mode. They're always selling something. Here's a three-pointer that makes the score 8-4, and they're acting like, you know, it's Jordan's last shot in 98. I never went that route. I think that, you know, what we did, and you think about Tom Hammond, you think about Dick Enberg, who played a role in it, you think about Marv Albert. I don't know how, top to bottom, a sport can be covered any better than the NBA on NBC in the 90s. And I think that's why people are looking forward to its return, even though most of those people aren't there anymore.
Yeah, and I mean, to the point about how beloved the NBA and NBC still is, I remember you were at the Tech Summit last year in Indianapolis for the NBA All-Star Game.
Sure.
And Ahmad Rashad is tossing to you, and you even pointed out it was the first time since NBC, and the late, great Bill Walton is just sitting there in the crowd watching. It was like a special little reunion at that event last year. And, you know, obviously nostalgia plays a role as well. But the point you made about, you know, not shilling for the league, but identifying those places where there is drama. And you think to yourself, for example, an open for Nuggets Heat 2 years ago in the finals, why not talk about Jokic's journey, right? And how unbelievable it is that he's now the best player in the league. And Jimmy Butler's journey, and kind of contrasting and comparing these underdogs. These are the types of things that obviously, you know, are part of creating the drama that you guys were doing.
Yeah, I think, look, and this is not get off my lawn stuff, the world changes. And a lot of what has been done subsequent to the prime of my career is high quality stuff by talented people. But sometimes I think that there's a feeling the more directorial cuts there are, the better. How often, forget about in a produced piece, in a live game, are you watching the game ends and all you want to see, we're on the cusp of March Madness here, all you want to see is the coaches walking toward each other, and what is that interaction going to be like? And the director thinks his Emmy reel will be better if he has 17 cuts in the next 17 seconds. And by the time he comes back, you've missed that moment. Sometimes the most obvious way to do it is the best way to do it. And a lot of these, you know, to your point about Butler and Jokic, I don't know what the open was on ABC. I do know that Mike Breen is a terrific play-by-play guy. But if it's like a lot of these things, it's like, let's see how many cuts we can have. And we can stick a little hip-hop track onto it and come at it from different angles. And now we're doing a sit-down that's going to be last for 15 minutes, but we're going to edit it down to 3 minutes anyway. But because we think the audience has the attention span of a gnat, let's just have a random shot from the floor, from the leg of the chair up, so that you see this guy out of focus. How about listening to what he has to say? If the question is good and if the answer is interesting, shouldn't that be enough instead of you trying to show off all your technical maneuvers and all the toys you happen to have in your toy chest? Just because you got a toy doesn't mean you have to use it every single time. Sometimes a straightforward approach is best. Now, I think there was, to your earlier point, there was a lot of artistry in what we did on NBC. But that artistry often played out, you know, not laboriously, but we weren't we weren't assuming that the audience didn't have enough of an attention span to pay attention for 3 minutes, you know? And now, you know, this happens a lot. There are producers who think they get a merit badge if they can take an interview that probably should play for 5 minutes. Ah, I cut it down to 2:43. Yeah, but what about the antecedent to this question? This question and answer make no sense without the thing that I made it shorter. Yeah, congratulations.
Bob, I do have to ask you, the end of the 98 finals, of course, sure. Jordan's last game with the Bulls, the last dance. One of the things you're remembered for, particularly fondly, is the essay you share at the end of the 1998 NBA Finals. Had you prepared anything ahead of time? Was anything written down? Okay.
Now, bullet points. But I didn't know, if the Bulls would win the game. If the Jazz win the game, they force a game 7, which they are a slight favorite to win because it would have been at the Delta Center. You don't know if that will fit the narrative, but we do know this, that only the Bulls could win the championship in game 6. So I'm not someone who scripts a call or scripts what I'm going to say in those situations. There are essays that you write that are scripted, and the producers need that because they're matching B-roll to it. Like the Sunday night halftimes, I'd finish them at some point in the second quarter, and that gave the producers enough time to put the appropriate images to it. But on that particular occasion, I didn't know, for example, that it would end as dramatically as it did. If you want something that typifies Michael Jordan's career, it's that last sequence in Game 6. So all that kind of fell into my lap. But the point that I had in the back of my head was, this isn't just potentially the end of the Bulls dynasty. You know, people think The Last Dance is something that a documentarian thought up in 2020. Phil Jackson had called it The Last Dance earlier that season. In fact, I'd forgotten, but during the Last Dance documentary, I heard myself say before game 5, when they were up 3-1, well, if this is the last dance, it might as well end on their dance floor. So the idea of last dance was in people's heads. And the idea that Michael Jordan might be stepping away was there too. So you had to couch it with some, you know, what ifs and possibly, and we don't know for sure type stuff. But the notion was, in my mind, was not just that this could be the end of the Bulls dynasty, but that in sports in general, we're seeing the end of an era where even though free agency has existed, the basic core of the great teams held together.
Well, for Bulls fans, there is, of course, cause for celebration tonight after a 6th championship that came harder than the others. But there's some anxiousness mixed in as well. Who knows how all of this will play out, but it's certainly possible that tonight we saw the last of the Chicago Bulls as we have known them. And whether it ends here or sometime in the near future, it'll be noteworthy not just for the breakup of one of the great teams in sports history, but because given the present structure of pro sports, it may be quite a while before we see anything like this again. Oh, the organizations that have the resources, the Yankees, the Braves, the Cowboys, the Lakers, and the NBA, will almost always field contending teams. But the days of continuity may be ending. Even on the best teams, there's now so much turnover that it's becoming ever harder to follow and identify with teams. Loyalty has been fragmented, which brings us to an underappreciated aspect of this golden era in the NBA. It hasn't just been Bird, Magic, and Michael. It was the whole recognizable cast of characters around them that gave the Celtics, the Lakers, and the Bulls their texture and made following them all the more interesting. Even the Jazz, noble runners-up 2 years in a row, are personified by the longest-tenured coach in the league and 2 Hall of Famers who have been teammates for well over a decade. We'll see championship teams in the future, but will we see teams that endure this way?
Now, as we've seen, with exceptions, the greatest players, Hall of Fame players, are going to wind up having played for 3, 4, 5 teams, you know? And you're rooting, as Jerry Seinfeld said, you're rooting for laundry. You're rooting for what uniform is the guy wearing? What's the core of my team? You know, at least give me 3 or 4 guys that have been here for the full run. So it was partly about the end of the Bulls dynasty, or likely end of the Bulls dynasty, but also, are we nearing the end of the long run in sports where you could feel like, this is my team. These are the principles. There may be changes around the edges, but the core of it is the same. And that went for the Jazz as well. You know, Stockton and Malone played their whole careers. I guess Malone went to the Lakers or somebody at the end, but, you know, so many years. And Sloan was at that point the longest tenured coach in the NBA. So there was a kind of stability there.
You know, obviously the last shot by Michael, Muhammad Ali, you know, holding the Olympic torch. I mean, these are some of the most iconic moments in the history of sports. You are there for so many of them. Is that era just something that we can never recapture? No matter how great the moments are, the Cavs winning the finals, the Cubs winning the World Series, you know, it just seems like there was something about the 90s and the mass culture that we had then.
You know, I think it was kind of when the past and future kind of met in a glorious present. You know, it wasn't in black and white anymore. We could show you a close play from six different angles by then. We had some pretty advanced production techniques, but the media landscape had not exploded. So, and this is one example of it. When you talk LeBron versus Michael, you can make an objective statistical basketball argument for LeBron, but you cannot make any argument when it comes to stardom or a certain kind of transcendent greatness, because since the games were on, there were games that were on TNT, but the biggest games were on NBC. And in the 80s, they were on CBS, Bird and Magic. And so the average fan, the casual fan, was talking about those games at the water cooler the next day at the office. And I've used this example before, just a little hyperbolic. No little old lady has ever said, "You know, Mildred, I'd love to play bridge with you tonight, but I gotta watch LeBron." But a million metaphorical little old ladies like that said that about Michael Jordan, even if they had no idea why Phil Jackson was now sending Judd Bushler into the game, you know, instead of Bill Wennington. They didn't care. And part of that was, of course, part of that, the big part was Michael himself. He wasn't just great. It was like he was a movie star. He was so charismatic. He was so perfect in every way in terms of broad appeal. But a good portion of it was right there on NBC. And it wasn't just the games. The promos are on Seinfeld and ER and Cosby and Friends and The Tonight Show and The Today Show and Brokaw's newscast. It's everywhere. And I think, you know, leagues are coming to terms with that now. The NFL is in its own category. They can just print money and have their own way. But you see both the NBA and MLB now trying to get back into more of network television. Now, is network television the same and as powerful now as it was in the 80s and 90s? Of course not. But it still matters more than the leagues may have thought. They took the bigger paycheck from cable, but they lost a lot of casual viewers in the process.
I got to ask about this, Bob. You mentioned Muhammad Ali a little while back. And in Dick Ebersol's book, he talked about how the Ali moment, that now iconic moment that you and Enberg capture so beautifully, almost didn't happen. How early were you told that there was a possibility that that would happen? Was it well in advance, or were you?
No. Now, Dick could have been. I read Dick's book, but I can't recall the exact passage precisely. But there are a couple of ways in which it almost didn't happen. One was that there was resistance from the Atlanta Organizing Committee, because at least someone on that committee said to Dick, "He may be a hero to you, but down here," meaning south of the Mason-Dixon line, "he is still a draft dodger." And Dick persuaded them that they were mistaken and that this would be not only good, it would be great if we could pull it off. The second reason why it might not have happened was that, and I only learned this years later when Janet Evans told me, Dick Ebersol didn't tell me this, no one did until Janet Evans, who was the second to last torchbearer, a great U.S. swimmer, she carried it up the steps. And then Muhammad literally stepped out of the shadows and received the torch from her. And they rehearsed it only one time because they wanted to keep it a secret. Dick wouldn't tell me and Dick Enberg who it was. Usually we'd have a tip off so that you could at least prepare something, especially if it was a foreign Olympics and you didn't automatically have all the biographical stuff about whoever that country's esteemed athlete or sports figure was that would be lighting the torch or the cauldron. So you'd have to do some preparation. He said, you'll recognize him or her instantly. You won't need any notes, but I want your reaction to be as spontaneous as everybody in the stadium. And then I began running the possibilities through my head. And briefly, I considered Ali, but then I dismissed the thought because I thought even then, 20 years before his death, even then he's not capable of doing it. And what I learned from Janet Evans only a few years ago was that they rehearsed it. I knew they had rehearsed it only one time at 3 o'clock in the morning so that almost no one outside the tight circle would be aware. But in the rehearsal, Muhammad dropped the torch because even then his hand and arm were shaking with the effects of Parkinson's. But when the time came, like a champion, he came through.
But look who gets it next. The greatest. Oh, my! And the response he evokes is part affection, part excitement, but especially respect. What a moment.
And it became one of the most iconic moments in Olympic history.
To the point you were just making about Ali and kind of some of the hard feelings left over from the 60s, you did an essay at halftime in 2012, right after Newtown. And a lot of people forget this context. Right after Jovan Belcher, you did an essay at halftime of a Sunday night game. And a lot of people to this day seem to kind of hold it against you. I just wanted to get your thoughts on how difficult it is to talk about these broader societal issues during a sports cast, whether or not you think there's room for that in this era.
Well, no matter what you do in this era, because things are so polarized and because, as we discussed earlier in a different context, you don't have to be a reasonable person or a person committed to honesty and fairness in order to have a voice now. So if you say anything other than there's a ground ball to shortstop, somebody is going to take exception and they're going to deal with it in an ad hominem way. And in my case, I became a convenient straw man for certain people on the right. I've often said this, and I'll try to make it as brief as possible. I didn't express myself on that gun essay as well as I generally think I do. I took for granted that what I was saying would be obvious. And what I was saying, and there's an irony here, ordinarily I either wrote or ad-libbed all those things myself. And there were about 3 minutes to go in the second quarter, and only then did I learn that they wanted me to do something specifically about the Jovan Belcher situation. So it's Sunday night, and by this time, I guess it happened on Saturday, by this time every show concerned with football, including an entire day on the other networks, has talked about this up and down. And our own halftime pushed aside all the highlights that they'd usually show of the earlier games and had interviews with Chiefs players and officials. It was all about that. And now they say, we want you to do your essay about that. And in retrospect, I wish I had just been left out of it, not because I was timid to comment, but I would have liked more time to assess what had been said and to let the dust settle a little bit. So a producer, and I'm not going to put any blame on him because in the end, I'm the goalie. You know, if I get credit for something that was largely done by somebody else just because I wound up delivering the information, you know, they're not getting as much credit as they should. So if there's some blame here, I'm going to take all the blame. He hands me this piece, which he pulled off the internet, that was written by Jason Whitlock. The irony here is that Jason Whitlock is now something of a hero on the right. But what Jason was saying, it was a much longer essay, but part of it was that there's a gun culture in the country from which nothing good ever comes. He wasn't saying, nor was I, nor do I think, that people should not have the right to have a gun if they own it responsibly, or guns to protect their home and family or for sporting purposes. But all you got to do, then or now, is Google athletes and guns and see the litany of folly, criminality, tragedy that's connected to it. And then if you want to be fair, if you want to look for the times when you said to yourself, boy, I'm glad that athlete had a gun, does it exist? Yeah, it exists, but it's minuscule alongside all the other stuff, which is not a Second Amendment question. It's a question of attitudes toward guns. And so part of Jason's point here was, if Jovan Belcher, whose state of mind could have been altered by the trauma of football, head trauma, could have been altered by performance-enhancing drugs or painkillers or alcohol or some combustible combination of all those things. But if, tragic as it would be, if a gun was not available and he used some other means, there's a much larger chance that his fiance and their child, well, I guess the child did survive, but that the fiance survives. The gun makes it so much easier for the worst possible outcome to happen. And the attitude toward guns has to play a part in that. I thought that was self-evident. And I also didn't have time in that one instance, in my mind, to do anything better than what Jason had put out there. And so I delivered that.
In the aftermath of the nearly unfathomable events in Kansas City, that most mindless of sports cliches was heard yet again. Something like this really puts it all in perspective. Well, if so, that sort of perspective has a very short shelf life, since we will inevitably hear about the perspective we have supposedly again regained the next time ugly reality intrudes upon our games. Please, those who need tragedies to continually recalibrate their sense of proportion about sports would seem to have little hope of ever truly achieving perspective. You want some actual perspective on this? Well, a bit of it comes from the Kansas City-based writer Jason Whitlock, with whom I do not always agree, but who today said it so well that we may as well just quote or paraphrase from the end of his article. Our current gun culture, Whitlock wrote, ensures that more and more domestic disputes will end in the ultimate tragedy, and that more convenience store confrontations over loud music coming from a car will leave more teenage boys bloodied and dead. Handguns do not enhance our safety. They exacerbate our flaws, tempt us to escalate arguments, and bait us into embracing confrontation rather than avoiding it. In the coming days, Jovan Belcher's actions and their possible connection to football will be analyzed. Who knows? But here, wrote Jason Whitlock, is what I believe. If Jovan Belcher didn't possess a gun, he and Cassandra Perkins would both be alive today.
And it immediately became, he hates the Second Amendment, he wants to take your guns away, blah, blah, blah. And why would he say this on a football game? Then the next year, the controversy about the Redskins team name bubbles to the surface. And on Wednesday or Thursday of the week preceding the game we had on Sunday night, and the game was Cowboys Redskins, NBC says, we want you to do an essay about this. They don't tell me what to say. They just say, do an essay on it. And it's on YouTube, and it's very measured, and it puts in all the stipulations and nuances. And my basic point was, get a dictionary. No dictionary defines Braves, Chiefs, Warriors as automatically racist or insulting or pejorative, but every dictionary defines Redskins as a slur, pejorative, and insult. So I delivered that essay. I wouldn't change a comma. And here's the response. It's inappropriate during a football game. Well, if it's not appropriate during halftime, now while the game is going on, if it's not appropriate during halftime of a game that involves the Redskins and the Cowboys in front of the biggest audience in all of television, a football audience, when the hell is it appropriate? You know, and the truth is that all the people who say stick to sports, all of them, they mean stick to sports if you're saying something that I don't want to hear. Nobody on Fox News, they're telling Barbara Streisand to shut up and sing and LeBron James to shut up and dribble. But when an athlete or an entertainer is aligned with their view of the world, not only do they not tell this person to shut up, they give him airtime, which they're perfectly entitled to do. This is America, I think, I still think this is America. I still think there are some common principles that are observed by most of us, if not all of those who hold what once were prestigious offices, and that's as far as I'll go, but it's their right to put right-wing entertainers or broadcasters or athletes on. But it's completely hypocritical to say, shut up or stick to sports, when the only reason they're saying that is that they don't like what you're saying. And of course, they have to make a straw man out of you. They have to take all the nuance, all the stipulations, all the track record that a person has. You know, I have to be a far left guy, right? I have to be a cartoon character. And it's not just me, it's everybody they wish to demonize or turn into an easy soundbite or a straw man. That's the way the game works. Nobody wants to hear a treatise on any issue, no matter how important, with the bases loaded in the ninth inning or during the two-minute drill in a big football game. But there's always shoulder program. For example, at the Olympics, I didn't do it when Michael Phelps was going to jump in the pool or Usain Bolt was getting in the blocks. But there are always little windows where interviews are done or where it's appropriate for an essay. And for those who say this is sports, have they no knowledge of what surrounded Jack Johnson and Jesse Owens and Jackie Robinson and Billie Jean King and Kurt Flood? Now, a lot of these issues are race issues or issues of gender. There are issues now. By the way, the issue of trans athletes, Fox News and the right wing dines out on that on a nightly basis because it's a good issue for them. They don't like to deal in the nuance of it, but it's a good issue for them. But so when they say stick to sports or there's no place for politics in sports, do they have no knowledge at all? Smith and Carlos in 68 at the Olympics, have they no understanding that the IOC itself and FIFA and other international organizations are very, very political? How do you explain going to China twice for an Olympics and to Putin's Russia for an Olympics? How do you explain what FIFA does? Put the World Cup in Qatar or Qatar, whatever you want to call it. Regardless of how you feel about it, the idea that the competition always takes place in a vacuum is ridiculous. Now, some of these issues are not as emotionally resonant, but they're still important. There's a political issue that explains why, for the time being, the A's are in Sacramento. It may not be a moral issue. You know, the issues of race and whatnot were moral issues for the most part, but it is a political issue. They couldn't get together. The team couldn't get together. The city, the state, whatever the dynamics are, couldn't get together, you know? So I have always been one who feels, you know, I grew up listening to Howard Cosell, you know, and with all his bombast and obnoxiousness at his worst, he was deeply intelligent and courageous at his best because he said things that now are self-evidently true that brought him a lot of heat when he said them, you know, and you know, if the internet didn't exist then, but people still could call the switchboard at ABC, they could send angry letters. And a lot of those letters were, what is that New York Jew doing defending that N-word boxer? Well, in the end, who was right? Not obviously those bigots were wrong, but any network executive who would have told Howard Cosell to be quiet would be wrong in his own way because he would have been a coward. So Rune Arledge gets a lot of credit for standing behind Howard Cosell. Now, part of that, too, things are complicated. Howard Cosell was entertaining. Even people who hated him couldn't turn away from him. If Howard was just deeply thoughtful, but, you know, came across like Mr. Peepers, then maybe it wouldn't have been as good television. Howard was simultaneously journalistic, controversial, and good TV. So I'm sure that was part of Arledge's calculation, just as in 72 in Munich, and Howard resented this for the rest of his life, Arledge determined that Jim McKay had the right sensibility and the right touch to preside over the unfolding drama and, as it turned out, tragedy of the hostage crisis and that Cosell's persona would be too in your face, and that Jim had a gentler touch. And that was also a correct judgment by Rune Arledge. But I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I read Jim Boughton's Ball Four. You know, I read Dick Schaap. I followed the essayists like Jack Whitaker and the work of Howard Cosell. At the same time, I loved Vin Scully and Jack Buck and Marty Glickman and Marv Albert. You know, there's no contradiction there in embracing the drama and the beauty and the shared excitement and the generational connections and the humor and all of that. It's a tapestry. But part of that tapestry, at least as I view it, has to be the issues and the storylines and the elephants in the room. And so I make no apologies for, I think, judiciously and proportionately addressing those issues.
Well, I think that's a great spot to end things on. There's so many things you could talk with Bob Costas about. But I do want to get you back to your night. And I just want to say thank you so much. And I obviously am speaking on behalf of Armand as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. It really has been an honor.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Armand, for being interested and for hearing me out. I think I've talked myself out at this point. I think I need to mute myself for about 24 hours. I still enjoyed it.
I mean, this is a highlight of what I've been doing. I've been doing this for 20 years. It's a highlight for me, and I'm sure it is for Armand as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks to you both.
All right. Well, I can just say one more time, it was an absolute honor and a privilege to host Bob Costas on this podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it, and we'll be back with more stuff next week.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now. And support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.